rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ronenberg, Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, the Honorable John R. Ronenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're going to go to the second case that was on our calendar. And I should take a moment to thank you for following what we request, and that is that you show up early in case of situations like this. The second matter on the calendar is State versus Luce. Looks like both of counsel are here and ready to go. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent so that we have that for the recording. The podium is also adjustable. There's a little toggle switch adjusted to suit your comfort and height. And whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of appellant Angela Lorraine Luce. While I raised three issues in my brief today, I'd like to focus only on the first two issues, as issue number three, the state has conceded. The first two issues, the trial court here committed reversible error, requiring reversal of Ms. Luce's DWI convictions in two ways. First, they committed reversible error by failing to suppress the results of Ms. Luce's blood test that was taken in violation of her right to due process. And second, they violated her right under Miranda because she was subject to a custodial interrogation at the time she was asked whether she had any needles on her, and she admitted that she did. That admission was the product of a non-Mirandized custodial interrogation, and the district court found it was not, but that was based on a clearly erroneous factual finding, which the state has agreed.
It seems that the parties agree on that subject.
That's correct.
That is, that she had been cuffed at the time that the questioning took place.
Correct. So whether or not that finding was clearly erroneous is not at issue today. It is whether or not, without that finding, it amounted to a non-Mirandized custodial interrogation.
And whether there was reversible error.
Correct. Whether or not it was harmless error.
Right.
And, of course, our position is that it was not harmless error, and it does require reversal of her DWI convictions. The court relied heavily upon both pieces of evidence that should have been suppressed, both the results of the blood draw as well as her admission that she had needles in her purse. The court talked about those two pieces of evidence numerous times in its written findings of fact, finding her guilty. We don't usually have the benefit of that when we have a jury trial. We're left to speculate. But here we know that the court, acting as the finder of fact, relied heavily upon that evidence in finding her guilty of misdemeanor DWI.
Ms. Lockwood, at least with regard to, I believe count two is the controlled substance in the system. Would it matter, at least as to that, focusing on that account and whether, assuming there was error, how would it be prejudicial if, unless separately, of course, the due process suppressed the blood, would you agree that, assuming that's not the case, then the syringe becomes even, if not relevant at all at that point?
Correct. To the count driving under the influence of any amount of a controlled substance, it didn't require any proof that she was impaired at the time, just that she had it in her system. And of course, the BCA results from the blood test are the strongest piece of evidence for that. And the conviction may still be able to be upheld if the BCA results are not suppressed, but the non-Mirandized statement is suppressed on that count. But we are asking that both pieces of evidence should have been suppressed and asking this court to reverse the convictions based upon that.
In addition, the cumulative effect of those
pieces of evidence also requires reversal.
And as to count one, could it be argued that it's only perhaps slightly less prejudicial in the sense, or more prejudicial from your standpoint, I should say, because there is a syringe found separately, the tow truck driver, the syringe found, would that not resolve the issue of a syringe being having a critical impact on the conviction?
If it were merely based, if the evidence, the admission were suppressed regarding the needles in her purse, the syringe seen by the tow truck driver was a capped syringe that he alleged was in the back seat of her vehicle. Now, the tow truck driver claimed he took a picture of it and showed it to the police officer. but this was admitted into evidence, and there was no arguments made.
You say it was admitted into evidence?
It was not admitted into evidence. And the arguments that were made were based upon, of course, her admission regarding the needles. So they were not able to litigate where that needle may have come from, what it was a cap syringe, whether it had even been used. And so they would have been able to focus more on the weight of that piece of evidence had had they known that it, the other evidence would have been suppressed. The admission regarding the needles would have been suppressed. They would have been able to litigate more the weight of the evidence of that cap syringe and whether or not it was credible from the tow truck driver and things like that. But they weren't given the opportunity to do so because of the admission of the needles. And you can see from the findings from the court, as well as the use by the state in oral or in closing arguments, that her admission regarding having needles in her purse played a large part. Now, there were needles found in her purse, but that was suppressed as an illegal search incident to arrest. So any reference to there being needles in her purse is directly tied to that admission. So if that admission was suppressed, then none of that evidence would come in, and it was not harmless error to allow that evidence in, as it did affect the court's finding of guilt in this case. In regard to the harmless error of the BCA report of the blood, it was absolutely not harmless error, especially considering this is a scientific BCA report. The Caulfield court was very clear that with a BCA report, even if the other evidence is strong and even sufficient to prove guilt, concluding that a BCA report impacts the verdict is almost always found. It's almost never harmless error to allow a BCA report that should have been suppressed into evidence simply by the fact that it is such strong indication of guilt, especially in cases like this.
Well, as to the presence of drugs in the system, I mean, that's kind of the end of the game for your client if that gets in.
Absolutely.
The remaining evidence on that subject does seem to be a bit equivocal. That is, she makes some statements, there are syringes, but there's really no other evidence that I could see of what was in her system.
Correct. Just the very low amount of morphine found by the BCA blood results, yes.
It's in the blood, or we're guessing?
Correct. It was a blood test. And we're basing that on the results of the BCA test, correct. Now, this court may rely on the findings of Johnson and McDonald when doing the due process application to this case. Although both Johnson and McDonald were license revocation cases, in State v. Mike, the Minnesota Supreme Court did apply that to the criminal context. So that three-factor test that's been used in license revocation cases has also been used in the criminal context, and it's appropriate to use that three-part test here. Now, in State v. Mike, it didn't result in the reversal of the conviction, and that's merely because in Mike, the advisory was not read at all. So there was no prejudicial reliance on an advisory that's not read. That's very different than an inaccurate advisory, and that is what we have here, an inaccurate advisory that misstated her criminal consequences of refusing a blood test. And it's very clear that appellant was unaware of the correct criminal consequences at the time she submitted to the test, which is demonstrated by the record. She never unequivocally consented, actually. She said, of course I'm going to take the test. I'm just asking questions. And then right after that, she said, I would rather get a gross misdemeanor than a DWI. But what she was submitting to was the test for the DWI. A gross misdemeanor would have been if she had refused the test. So it's clear from her statement while being prepared to have her blood drawn that she did misunderstand the advisory, was not properly advised by the police officer.
Explain that a little bit more. What's the misunderstanding?
Well, the overall misunderstanding is that she would have been convicted of a crime had she refused the blood test. The only time blood or urine was stated by the officer was the initial statement that he had a warrant. He said, I have a warrant for blood or urine. I want a blood test. If you refuse a blood test, it is a crime. And then there were several minutes of whether refusing a blood test or a DWI, they were discussed which one was a more severe penalty. It was never addressed that had she refused the blood test, she would have to be offered a urine test, a much less intrusive test, before she could be charged with a crime.
Right. So it wasn't complete as to the urine. But you're not making, there wasn't a mistake relative to the gross misdemeanor for refusal and a misdemeanor for DWI.
No.
Okay. That's what I was confused about. That information from the officer, you're not arguing that information was incorrect.
It was accurate. Because
okay.
A test refusal is a gross misdemeanor. And in her case, a DWI, her first one, was a misdemeanor.
And I think you argue, do you not, that had she understood or been properly advised, she would have opted instead for a urine test.
You say that
in your brief. I think she would have.
She may have refused or she may have opted for a urine test. It's absolutely a reasonable inference to assume here that she would have opted for the less intrusive urine test.
It's a reasonable inference from the...
from the case law that discusses how intrusive a blood test is, how much more intrusive a blood test is than
not from her own. She didn't testify at the hearing, right?
She did not testify at the hearing, no.
And so if she would have, assuming even that there's a basis to determine from the evidence that she would have chosen a urine test had she understood that, what's the prejudice then?
The prejudice is the fact that she submitted to the test based on the inaccurate advisory. The case law doesn't indicate we have to prove that she was prejudiced by the results of the test, whether it was blood or urine. But the fact that she prejudicially relied on the advisory in deciding to submit to the blood test. She may have not decided to submit to the blood test. She may have refused. She may have requested a urine test alternatively. And that's the prejudicial reliance. That intrusive search of her veins, the intrusive entry of a needle into her body to draw her blood in a medical setting is her prejudicial reliance. She was reluctant, did not want her blood drawn. Even while it's being drawn, she states, I didn't know if I wanted to do this.
Right. The fact, I think, is not, the fact of actually giving... submitting to the test, I don't think, is per se prejudicial reliance. I think under the case law, we have to determine whether, as a factual matter, the driver actually relied on an inaccurate advisory, right? So as a factual matter, what are the facts that tell us that it was the inaccuracy of what you describe as an inaccuracy or at the very least incompleteness of it wasn't an advisory, but it was the information that was given by the officer. How do we know without her testimony what prompted her to give the blood test? How do we know that she wouldn't have given a urine test anyway or maybe even decided to give the blood test had she been fully informed without her testimony as to what influenced her decision?
I do concede that it is a difficult conclusion to make without having the record be able to expand upon what she was thinking at the time she consented to the test, and had she known she had an alternative, whether she would have refused or chosen that alternative. But when you take an entire review of the record and you look at the case law, when someone submits to a test based on an inaccurate advisory, they are prejudicially relying. The case law that discusses lack of prejudicial reliance is based upon someone either refusing the test or someone not being given the advisory at all. Now, I do agree that if this court is not able to find from the facts that it has before it, it does have the option of a remand to remand for further fact-finding regarding that prejudicial reliance factor.
And why instead isn't the issue just simply waived since the... Your client didn't raise it below. So the opportunity was there. The law was there. The opportunity was there. There would have been opportunity to cross-examine her on on the issue. It seems the fact that a factual record isn't made is usually dispositive at this point of a forfeited issue, is it not? Rather than send it back. I mean, we might take it if the record is complete, but we wouldn't generally take a forfeited issue and send it back to have another swing at it.
And my first argument is this issue is not forfeited because it was raised under the general argument that it was taken in violation of her right to refuse. While not extensively argued in the memorandum of law in support of the motion to suppress, the motion to suppress raised three issues. One, of course, was the violation of her right to counsel. The other was the Miranda violation. And the first one was that the test was taken in violation of her right to refuse. And that was discussed on the transcript during the Rasmussen hearing, whether or not she was properly informed and whether or not she understood she could refuse and whether or not she actually consented voluntarily to the test. And those are all factors that are relevant to the prejudice here and connected to the due process argument because it all relates to someone's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures and to be protected by due process of law. And even if you find that this argument was forfeited by not being raised below, it still absolutely, in the interest of justice, should be addressed here today. We do meet the factors for addressing this in the interest of justice, as I did lay out in my brief. And additionally, your concern about the remand. While I didn't cite to this case in my brief, there is an unpublished case from 2019, January of 2019, from this court in State versus Hulsby, 2019 Westlaw 272934.
Can you give me the last digits again?
272934.
Thank you. Hulsby?
Yes. And in Hulsby, the court, they did not have a warrant at the time, but the defendant was told that failure to test would be a crime. And they used the three-part test from Johnson and McDonald and said that they failed to prove the prejudicial reliance in that case, and the remedy was a remand. So in that unpublished case, I did not admit, I did not cite to, but in response to your question, there is unpublished case law allowing for a remand for just that
so
prejudicial Hulsby, reliance factor.
Hulsby is unpublished authority for the notion that we ought to import the Johnson-McDonald analysis into a 171.
State versus Mike also allows you to do that. In State versus Mike, in the criminal context, they use the three-part test from McDonald and Johnson. And I see my time has run, so I ask
you. Oh, you can go ahead and finish if you would.
It's the three-part test from Johnson, and just in Mike, they held it didn't apply because he was not given an advisory at all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use that time.
May it please the court. My name is Amy Tripp Steiner, Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney, appearing on behalf of Respondent, State of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests that this court deny appellant's due process argument, affirm the district court's admission of appellant's statement about the needle, and remand to correct the sentencing error. Your Honors, the due process argument that's being raised for the first time on appeal should not be permitted to go forward. As the court is aware, generally issues that were not raised at the district court are not allowed to be brought forward on appeal, and that includes issues of constitutional questions, including due process arguments that are raised for the first time have been excluded by this court time and time again. And this court also has noted before that an appellant can't try to bring an issue that was argued in one manner at the district court and then now try to re-argue it in a slightly different manner. Because there was a constitutional issue that was raised at the district court, the umbrella of that constitutional argument doesn't allow them to change it from a Sixth Amendment, which was a right to counsel argument that was handled at the district court, to now bringing it into a 14th Amendment due process argument. And you look at the bodies of case law that surround the Sixth Amendment issue of Friedman and Mike and Hunt and ultimately Rosenbusch, and compare that to the due process arguments and case law of McDonald, Johnson, and Morehouse. They're just very separate bodies of case law. These were absolutely issues that could have been raised at the district court. When you look at Johnson and Morehouse came out in May of 2018, and this Rasmussen hearing happened in October of 2018, so there isn't an argument to be made that there was any new case law that should change that would be working in the interest of justice of the appellant to allow this argument to go forward. That was whatever the strategy was at the district court. The focus for the constitutional issue was about the right to counsel. And not a due process argument where you have to analyze the three factors from McDonald that were affirmed by Johnson and Morehouse. While this court can, in exceptional circumstances, allow interest of justice, it has to act as also has to be not an unfair surprise. And this issue wasn't raised. As the court has already outlined, there wasn't an opportunity to ask additional questions, call additional officers, have the appellant even testify. There's all these facts that are not a part of the record. And so this new due process argument should just be summarily denied as it wasn't raised at the district court. For the second issue about the needle that was found in there, the state does concede a review of the body-worn camera does show that Officer Cholton had put the appellant in handcuffs prior to inquiring about the location of about needles. But when you
so that factual finding was clearly erroneous.
It was. However, it doesn't change the end analysis, Your Honor, that when you look at the totality of what was happening at that time, when the officer first arrived on scene, he made contact with a tow truck driver. And what was argued previously is that we're unsure if the officer had been shown a picture from the tow truck driver. That was a stipulated fact that was agreed to by the parties in this case when it was submitted for to the district court, that the tow truck driver had seen the syringe, had taken a picture, and had shown that to the officer. The officer then, as you see in the body-worn camera, then turns and sees appellant standing at the back of her vehicle, digging through her purse. He notes that she's acting erratically, fervent movements. As he gets closer and speaks to her, he notices these constricted pupils. He asks her about the syringe in the vehicle, and that's when she admits that she has a heroin problem and that she's in treatment. So during this entire interaction, he still doesn't know where that needle is located. He then goes back to the tow truck driver and then asks where he had seen it on the seat, that it was in the front seat, and then noted, asked if she had moved, if he thought that she had moved the syringe, and he said, yes, that's the tow truck's response, driver's response. So then he goes back to the appellant, and based on everything that he's seeing, we're almost about 3 minutes into this interaction. He had testified at the Rasmussen hearing that he had officer safety concerns, public safety concerns, and that her behavior was concerning in general, and that he then put her into handcuffs. He then, after he puts her into handcuffs, he asks her if there's anything on you that I need to be concerned about. And so when we look at if this is, even if she is in some type of custody, which there's an argument under the VU factors that didn't amount to a custody at that time, but even if she was, it wasn't the product of a custodial interrogation. And his question about, is there anything on you that I need to be concerned about, needles, is really not meant to elicit a statement about needles in another location. It wasn't meant to elicit about there. He's asking about her because he's about to do a pat frisk of her, and he has serious concerns. He doesn't know where this needle is, and so he focuses his question about on her person. She then volunteers the response. When they asked if there's anything on you, she says, no, there is in my purse, you can check. He responds, there's a needle in your purse, to which she says, yes. And then he goes, nothing on you. He's now affirming it. She says, no. He says, no needles, no. And then he conducts a pat frisk. So the fact that she volunteered the response isn't a Miranda violation. This is not the product of a custodial interrogation and definitely was not a question that was meant to elicit an incriminating response. And even if this court does find that the statement was omitted in error, it surely does not affect the outcomes of the first two counts. As the court noted for count two, the admission of there being a needle in that area is not a necessary element for count two. When you look at count one, the totality of all the other findings that the district court made in that case, the needle was not a necessary, the linchpin to count one, if we would say. The district court made specific findings that she was under the influence of a controlled substance based on her hitting a legally parked vehicle, that the officer had seen the picture of the syringe from the tow truck driver, that the officer had seen her pupils to be constricted, her anxious movements, she was unable to calm down. Fourth, that the appellant told the officer that she had an addiction to heroin and she was struggling in treatment for. And the district court made findings that Officer Cholton had extensive experience with individuals who were under the influence of a controlled substance, and that based on his training and experience, Officer Cholton believed appellant was under the influence of heroin. That's not a clearly erroneous finding of credibility based on the officer's training and experience. So even, and what I just told the court here doesn't mention anything about the needle, the statement made by the appellant. So when you look at the totality of that, of whether the appellant was still guilty of count one, the needle is not a necessary element for that. And then it does not affect count three as well because that was not a consideration for the court. Your Honors, if this, going back to the first issue about the due process argument, that if this court were to allow the appellant's argument to go forward, it would still fail. There is not a factual record to support under the test of McDonald that she prejudicially relied on the advisory and that the advisory was inaccurate. When you, there's a three-prong test, and the first part was obviously met because she did take a test. However, the appellant did not testify at the district court, and so when you look at back all the way to McDonald and the Mosier portion of there and why they made a finding that she had prejudicially relied on the advisor at that time was based on her own testimony. She talked about why she submitted to the test because she thought that she had no other choice. All of that is a fact-based issue, and the burden is on the appellant when we're talking about prejudicial reliance. And it cannot be inferences that are to be made. We have to show actual prejudice. So we're not to speculate as to what her mindset was, because what the evidence that we have here is that she complied. The officer advised her and asked if she would be submitting to a blood test, and when directly asked, she said, "Of course I'm going to do it. I'm just asking questions." And during the 10 minutes from the time when the advisory was read to when the blood draw was completed, at no time did she affirmatively say, "Stop, I'm not going to do this anymore." She sat in for 5 minutes. On the video, you can see she holds her arm there and lets the nurse take the blood samples. Even sits there even when the first time when he tried to do it and it didn't work, and then he had to find a different vein. She sat there. At no point did she say, "I'm not going to do this." She didn't ask for a urine test. None of that information is before this court to make any type of finding that there was prejudicial reliance. And
Rip, would you concede that the statement, though, the officer indeed was inaccurate in the sense that the statutory requirement of explaining that blood or urine, refusing to submit to blood or urine is a crime, was not given?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's actually an inaccurate statement. When you look at 171-177, subdivision 1, in there it talks about that at the time that a test is, at the time a blood or urine test is directed pursuant to a search warrant, so there's an or in there, the person must be informed that refusal to submit to a blood or urine test is a crime. And so it does not, the statute does not require that at the outset that the officer says, "I have a search warrant for your blood and urine. Refusal to take a blood and urine is a crime. I'm now directing a blood test." That's not how it's written, because subdivision 2, when you read that in conjunction with that, the officer gets to pick the test. And for whatever reasons, there are certain, you know, they have their reasons why they get to do that. And it is not the subject that gets to select which test that they get to take at first blush. So when you look at 171-177, it says that at the time a blood test is directed, and you read that in conjunction with the last part of the sentence, then they must be informed that the blood, refusal to take that blood test is a crime.
Can I just inquire, and I understand why you're reading those two together, how would a driver ever know that they have an option to refuse one to choose the other if they're not told at the beginning that you can choose either blood or urine?
And it's interesting, Your Honor, because technically they don't really have an option. It's not that they have a right to refuse, they can refuse. And so if...
Well, just to back up, but isn't it true, though, if all you say as here, it's a crime to refuse a blood test, and they refuse a blood test, they cannot be charged with a crime until the officer says, "Well, will you take a urine test?" And if you choose now to fail that. So my point I'm getting at is, and the focusing on subdivision one, isn't it true that a driver just will never know that option unless told that option at the beginning? If it's just like here, then as she would have testified to, that I assume I had no choice. Because at that point, she was not told of a choice.
It is true that she could not have been charged with refusal until she had refused both the blood and then the urine test. That is true. But when you look at the fact that when you read through 171-177, it doesn't mandate that the individual has to be told at the outset that they have to refuse both of them to be charged with a refusal. While it's true that you have to be offered both, it's not that they have to be that's not how the statute reads. And even if Officer Schmidt in this case wasn't the most artful with how he indicated the advisory, she was told at the outset that "I have a search warrant here to draw the blood or urine from you." So it's not like he never even said urine. Yes, she wasn't advised at that point that refusal to submit that to that at the same time would be a crime. But it's, I don't believe that this is an inaccurate advisory. The state takes a position it's not an inaccurate advisory. And if there's to be any type of due process violation found, you have to have all three prongs. There has to be that there's a test, there has to be prejudicial reliance, and there has to be an inaccurate advisory. And there definitely is not prejudicial reliance shown here. There were questions about whether it would be appropriate to remand the case back. And while I also didn't cite this in my brief, in response, in Windsor versus Commissioner of Public Safety, which is a published case, which is 921 Northwest 2nd 71, Minnesota Court of Appeals from 2018. In that case, they asked to remand to make a better record in light of Morehouse and Johnson, and this court found that that was not the appropriate remedy. That there was, and so that is not the appropriate remedy here as well.
So, what was the appropriate remedy in Windsor? That should be raised by post-conviction petition, or that it should be addressed on the merits and rejected now?
Addressed on the merits and rejected is my understanding of how that case was. So even if this court were to then look at the merits here, appellant has failed to meet her burden that she prejudicially relied on the advisory, and thus the due process argument would fail. If there are no further questions, I think I have less than a minute. I'll concede the rest of my time.
It seems we have none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lockwood, do you wish to use your rebuttal time? May.
Your Honor, the state claims that it was not an inaccurate advisory reading Minnesota Statute 171.177. I believe that is a misstatement. In 171.177, it states that at the time a blood or urine test is directed pursuant to a search warrant, the person must be informed that refusal to submit to a blood or urine test is a crime. Now, the state is correct that the officer may choose which test to request.
That's in subdivision 2.
That is in subdivision 1. The fact that they may choose is in subdivision 2.
The decision can be made by the officer under subdivision 2.
Correct.
Go ahead.
But if the officer chooses to request a blood test, for instance, they still must give the advisory that refusal to give a blood or urine test is a crime. And had they done that, then the person being advised would know there are two tests. I know I'm being asked for a blood test, but perhaps I can inquire as my options for a urine test, which is less intrusive.
Ms. Lockwood, is there a distinction in your mind legally? And if so, what would it be if this was interpreted as an incomplete statement as opposed to an inaccurate advisory? And incomplete obviously meaning that it was correct up to the point if you refuse the blood, but what she was not told is you have the choice of a blood or urine. Do you see a distinction there? And if so, what would it mean for your client?
I do not see a distinction, Your Honor. And that's because even if it is an incomplete advisory, that incomplete advisory still leaves the person being advised with an inaccurate understanding of the legal consequences of their refusal to test. Because the incomplete advisory only relates to your refusal for blood and states that if you refuse this request for a blood test, you will be charged with a crime. That is not true. By their incomplete statement required under the statute, they are giving inaccurate legal advice. And under Johnson and McDonald, that's exactly what violates due process, is when someone relies on an inaccurate or possibly incomplete advisory that misstates the legal consequences of refusing the test, whether that be license revocation or whether that be test refusal. And in this case, that's exactly what we have.
So can you explain to me, so in Mike, which was a suppression case then, in a criminal case, that we concluded that because the purpose of the advisory in 171-177 is to encourage submission to testing and not refusal, that purpose is not subverted if a driver submits to a test without being read the advisory. Because it's not subverted, even the failure to comply with the advisory requirement, it wasn't a grounds for suppression. Now, I understand that that dealt with the absence of an advisory, but when we're talking about the purpose of the statute to determine whether suppression is the answer, what's the difference between an absence of an advisory and an inaccurate advisory when the goal is to encourage taking the test?
Your Honor, my response would be very similar to the one that I gave Justice Sleater, which is when it's an incomplete or non-existent advisory that does not misstate the legal consequences, then it doesn't run afoul of the purpose of the statute, which is, of course, to compel someone to give a test. But in this case, it misstated the legal consequences of refusing the blood test. Now, we don't know whether appellant would have opted for a urine test, and that still would have been within the purpose of the statute to provide a test. But the purpose of the statute is not to coerce someone into providing a specific type of test, and that's what happened here. Now, the state argued that appellant didn't prejudicially rely in part because there's no evidence she requested a urine test. Well, again, the concern raised by Justice Sleater, how would someone know that you had the option to request a urine test had you not been advised? And now this person who was given this inaccurate advisory had never been arrested for a DWI before. She had very limited experience, likely had no knowledge of the test refusal law, which is, of course, still in flux today. And she was given that inaccurate advisory, so it's reasonable that she had no idea she could have opted for a urine test, and it's also a reasonable inference that she would have opted for the less intrusive test had she known she would not be convicted of a crime for simply refusing the blood test and then being offered the urine test. If there are no further questions, I'd ask this court to reverse and remand the DWI convictions in this case. Thank you.
The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days. Again, thank you to counsel for being here and ready to go. Before we get to